Growing up, many of us are familiar with stories that were told in our childhood. They all seem to begin with the same phrase, once upon a time. And we would enter a world of kings and queens, princes and knights, good and evil, as well as love and romance and marriage. What wonderful stories they were. After all the twists and turns, wrong is finally defeated. Goodness prevails as peace returns, and the same six words announce the ending that we children love to read. And they lived happily ever after. Cinderella did. Sleeping Beauty and Prince Charming did. Even Beauty and the Beast lived happily ever after. And then reality sets in. We grow up. And we realize that our stories don't always turn out that way. Or at the very least, our perspective changes. For some, it's a little earlier than others. I'm reminded of a four-year-old girl who came home from preschool excited to tell her mom the story that they had heard at preschool. And so she tells about the beautiful young woman, a princess who was fast asleep, and along came a handsome prince who kissed her, and she suddenly awoke. And do you know what happened next? She said excitedly. And the mother said, yes, they lived happily ever after. And the little girl said, no, they got married. We have come to the conclusion of the book of Job. We want to know, how did it all turn out? He's been through so much. How is it going to end? What about his friends? What about his wife? What does God have to say to all of them? And we find the answers in the final 11 verses of Job chapter 42, which we'll be spending our time this morning as we wrap up this series on the book of Job. First thing that we see is the rebuke of Job's friends. That is in verses 7 through 9. After the Lord had said these things to Job, he said to Eliphaz the Temanite, I am angry with you and your two friends, because you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has. So now take seven bulls and seven rams, and go to my servant Job and sacrifice a burnt offering for yourselves. My servant Job will pray for you, and I will accept his prayer and not deal with you according to your folly. You have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has. So Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite did what the Lord told them, and the Lord accepted Job's prayer. The first action that happens is the three friends of Job need to be set straight. Now, God addresses Eliphaz, but he is speaking to all three of them. Wherever he says you in this passage is plural in the original language. He might be saying you all, or if he was from the South, y'all. Y'all ain't right. And he says that he's angry with them. Why? Because of their poor theology. What they have been saying all this time about God has not been right. Now, can you picture the scene? Earlier, God is speaking to Job out of the whirlwind. And I'm sure these three guys kind of step back away. You know how you do that when you think God's about to strike somebody with lightning? You don't want to be too close to him. But I imagine that they're standing back, listening to God as he is speaking to Job. Maybe their arms are folded, got a frown on their face. They're wondering why divine lightning hasn't struck Job yet. Why the Lord isn't vindicating them and their words and rewarding them for what they had done. Are they in for a surprise? When the Lord finally does speak to them, it's not in terms of commendation, but condemnation. He says, I am angry with you because you have not spoken right about me. Now, it's true, God had to set Job straight. We saw that in the last message. But his words to Job's friends are much stronger. Job had been genuinely groping for the truth. He had never lost his faith in God, but he also knew of his own integrity. But these friends have spoken falsely in their attempt to defend God. More than just failing to comfort Job, they were actually tempting him to take the wrong course of action, since their counsel would have taken him away from the true worship of God. They're accused of folly. Now, that word in the original language is a word that was used earlier in the book of Job. Do you remember when Job's wife came to Job in the midst of his affliction and said, why don't you just curse God and die? And Job said to his wife, you're talking like a foolish woman. That same word in the Hebrew is used here as God tells Job's friends, you're speaking of me foolishly. This is your folly. He had to set them straight because they had gone too far to uphold God's justice. They ignored his mercy. They limited his sovereignty. I've mentioned earlier that they tried to make God into a formula. And when you make God into a formula, now he's predictable. And you really box him in. Now he's not sovereign. He cannot do as he pleases. He must do as we know he'll do. That's what the friends did. And God says, you're not going to box me in. You're not going to put limits on my sovereignty. Furthermore, they lacked mercy in their words. They thought that suffering always came because of the person's sin, and that's not always the case. They lacked sympathy and compassion. Now, I want you to notice that in these verses, God refers to Job no less than four times as my servant. And as you look at that phrase throughout the Old Testament, you'll see that that is a title of honor. To be acknowledged as God's servant is something you see of Moses, of David, of some of the outstanding individuals in the Old Testament. It was a high praise indeed to be called God's servant. And God mentions four times in three verses that Job is my servant. You say, well, how did Job serve God? By enduring the suffering and not cursing God, he silenced the devil. Wouldn't it be great to know that you shut the mouth of Satan before God? To know that by your faithfulness to God, you closed his mouth. Wouldn't that be great to know? That's what Job did. That's how Job served God. Now, God commands the three friends to bring an offering. Seven bulls and seven lambs. I'm not sure if that meant each one of them had to bring seven bulls and seven lambs, or if between the three of them they did. Either way, this is a costly offering. When God would institute the sacrificial system later on under Moses, he would command for one bull or one lamb to be brought for a sacrifice. Here, seven of each. This is how serious God took what these men had done. And notice what he says will be done here. You are to bring the sacrifice, and Job will pray for you. Talk about turning the tables. They're going from being his accusers. What'd you do wrong, Job? You must have done something wrong to deserve all this suffering. And now Job is praying on their behalf. I think this says a couple of things. One, it shows that God had fully restored Job to his place of favor. And secondly, by Job being willing to pray for those who had tormented him for so long. It says a lot about Job. He was willing to forgive them. He was willing to extend them the grace that they did not extend to him. If he had applied what most of us think of as the golden rule, do unto others as they do unto you, he would never have prayed for them unless it was praying for a divinely appointed Mack truck to run them over. I guess they didn't have Mack trucks back then, so maybe a divinely appointed caravan of camels to stomp through them. But no, Job prays for them to be forgiven, for them to be restored. And I believe that not only were the three friends reconciled to God through the sacrifice and the prayers of Job, but I think that Job and his three friends were reconciled as well. Now, one thing we got to be careful about here. Some will mistakenly use this passage to suggest that if you really want your prayers answered, you need to find somebody that has more clout with God and have them pray for you. I get this a lot just because of my profession. People think that because I'm a minister, that my prayers mean more to God. They don't. I am no different than anybody else. And the Bible teaches there is one mediator between God and man, and that's Jesus. You don't have to pray, you don't have to have somebody else pray for you because they're going to be heard more by God. You don't have to pray through saints or through Mary or through anybody else. Each one of us can go directly into God's presence. We have that privilege. What God is doing here is he's making a point. He's making a point to these three friends that you've been wrong all along. Job is the one that's right. And this is as much symbolic in nature as anything else. So don't read too much into that passage that now I've got to go find somebody more spiritual than me because if they pray, then it's going to mean more to God. That's not necessary. I'm not saying we shouldn't have other people pray for us. Just don't think that because someone's a pastor or a missionary or whatever, that they have more clout with God. They don't. You can go to God directly. But I think something we learn here is that God will use us in amazing ways in the lives of others once we get our perspective straightened out. Sure, Job had some uncomfortable, awkward moments in chapters 38 to 42 as God's kind of putting him in his place. But Job accepted that. And when Job got his perspective straightened out, God was then able to use him in ministering in the lives of others, even those who had given him such a hard time. God used him to bring them back to God. Now, I really believe the sequence of events here is essential to understand the book of Job. If the friends had never been reprimanded, that only God had spoken to Job out of the whirlwind, we might think that the friends were right. We might get the impression that they've been vindicated, Job's been humbled. But that's not where the story ends. It's Job who is vindicated. It is the three friends who are humbled before God. And I think there's a lesson to be learned in how God worked. Yes, he spoke to Job first, but he did that first so that when he spoke to the three friends, Job was in a position to minister to them. And there may be times when he calls us to minister to those who have hurt us, those who have wrongly accused us, those who have spoken wrongly to us. We may be called to minister to them. The second thing we see in this passage is the restoration of Job's fortune. Look at verse 10. After Job had prayed for his friends, the Lord made him prosperous again and gave him twice as much as he had had before. All his brothers and sisters and everyone who had known him before came and ate with him in his house. They comforted and consoled him over all the trouble the Lord had brought upon him. And each one of them gave him a piece of silver and a gold ring. The Lord blessed the latter part of Job's life more than the first. He had 14,000 sheep, 6,000 camels, 1,000 yoke of oxen, and 1,000 donkeys. He also had 7 sons and 3 daughters. The first daughter he named Jemima, the second Keziah, and the third Karen Huppuk. Nowhere in all the land were there found women as beautiful as Job's daughters, and their father granted them an inheritance along with their brothers. As God had taken everything, actually God didn't, as Satan had taken everything away from Job, God restores back to Job, and he does so twofold. He has given double everything that he had before. You might say, no, wait a minute. He had 10 children before, and he only has 10 children now. But if you think about it, the number of his children has doubled. He has 10 in heaven, he has 10 on earth. So he ends up with 20 children. He has double all of the material goods that he had had before. He is reunited with his friends. I think this also shows he was reunited with his wife. Friends and relatives come and they comfort him, they console him. They each give him a piece of silver and a gold ring. Maybe this was a restoration fund. Maybe this is how his fortunes were restored. He was able to purchase the cattle again and all of the animals that he had. And if this double formula applies to Job's age, we see in the next verse that Job lived another 140 years. He may have been 70 at the time this happened. So God even extended his life twofold. The idea here is that Job was blessed even more than what he had lost. Everything that had been taken from him, he was given back and more. The blessing was far greater than the suffering he had endured. But you know, the greatest blessing Job experienced wasn't getting 10 more children. By the way, I just kind of think that was also God's way of dealing with Job's wife. For suggesting curse God and die. You're going to have 10 more children. Maybe. But you know, the greatest blessing Job experienced was knowing God better. Understanding his ways a little bit clearer. James wrote in James 5:11, "You have heard of the perseverance of Job and seen the purpose of the Lord, that the Lord is very compassionate and merciful." You see how the compassion and the mercy of the Lord is tied to his purpose? It is a purpose of God to demonstrate his love, his grace, and his mercy. Sometimes that's done through difficulty. Sometimes that's done only through adversity. We may only learn of God's great love and mercy and grace because he brings us through the suffering that we have in life. That's part of his purpose. And then we come to the conclusion of the book, the final two verses. After this, Job lived 140 years. He saw his children and their children to the fourth generation. And so he died, old and full of years. That phrase, old and full of years, that was the goal of every person in the ancient world. And it didn't just mean you had a long life, it meant you had a long and full life. A life that ended well. You see the same phrase applied to Abraham and Isaac, later on of King David. This was a blessed life, a life that was full and complete. What an enviable way to reach the end of our days here on earth. That we can say we've lived a full life. Now, I'm not saying that he lived happily ever after. That's not possible in this fallen world. I'm sure that Job, in his last two-thirds of his life, experienced illness. I'm sure in dealing with 10 more kids, there were challenging days. There were probably some financial setbacks along the way. There were times when people would have offended him. Why? Because he lives in a world full of sinners. Job himself, still a sinner. And that's true for us as well. We are not going to live a carefree life on this earth. As long as we are here, we have to battle our own sin nature. We have to encounter the sin nature of others. We live in a world that is cursed by sin that it was introduced to the world at the very beginning. But that doesn't mean that we can't live with satisfaction. It doesn't mean that we cannot experience contentment and fulfillment. Henry David Thoreau once wrote, "None are so old who have outlived enthusiasm." Isn't it wonderful to meet one of those senior saints that's still alive? That's still full of life and enthusiasm? It's contagious. It rubs off on people around them. When you see somebody that's living much younger than their chronological age, I think that's great. I think God is pleased to see that. And that's the way Job was. Now I want to conclude our study with the relevance of Job's fate. What does it mean to us today? I think most people are probably pleased with the happy ending to the story. Started out, Job walked with God. He was an upright man. He had a good family. He was blessed by God. He had a wonderful reputation. And very quickly, he lost it all. And in addition to all of the losses and all the suffering and the pain, he was falsely accused over and over and over again. And yet now at the end, he comes out on top and he starts off even better than where he had started. Sounds great, doesn't it? Well, not everybody thinks that way, especially among Bible scholars. Some complain that the story is ruined by the happy ending, that for some reason the author has slipped back into that crude theology of rewards and punishments that the three friends have been talking about all that time. One of them's Harold Kushner. He was the Jewish rabbi that wrote that best-selling book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. This is his conclusion. The biblical book of Job adds a happy ending that once brought a close to the fable. After the soaring eloquence of God's words from the whirlwind, the simple-mindedness of this ending, here you are, Job, more wealth, more children, strikes us as anticlimax and leaves us puzzled as to why God would rebuke the three friends who had defended him and affirm Job who had challenged him. Clearly, whoever put these words into God's mouth was unfamiliar with the poem. He says, we'd be better off without this ending to the book of Job. I disagree. I think this ending is needed to see that God did not agree with the three friends. That Job was righteous and is vindicated in the end. Now understand, in those days, they didn't have a full concept of eternal rewards and punishment. And so God spoke to them in a way they could understand, which was, I'm going to bless Job now. We have the benefit of hindsight. We live on this side of the cross. We understand what they didn't in Job's day. even though Job had a glimpse of hope, that maybe there was something beyond this existence that hadn't been fully revealed yet. And so by God blessing Job, it was an object lesson that it does pay to serve the Lord. Faith in God is rewarded. And that's clearly seen the way the book ends. I want to conclude with a few lessons we learn, not just from this passage, but from the entire book. First, suffering's a part of life. Because we live in the world we live in, because we live in bodies that are cursed by sin, there's going to be suffering. Sometimes that suffering is the result of our own sin. Choices have consequences. We reap what we sow. Sometimes we make a decision and it comes back on us. Sometimes suffering comes by the decisions others make, because those consequences of choice are not confined only to the one who chooses. Sometimes others are impacted by our choices. Sometimes we are impacted by others' choices. There are other times when suffering is the ultimate result of Adam and Eve's original sin, which brought disease, disaster, deformity, and death into our world. And sometimes, as we learn in the book of Job, suffering has a spiritual element to it. Sometimes it's our adversary, Satan, who is instrumental in causing suffering that it touches our lives. And sometimes God allows us to go through difficult times in order to bring us closer to Himself. Now, our response is not to try to figure out the cause, but to turn in faith to the Creator. If that's one thing we should learn from the book of Job, don't be so caught up in what caused the suffering, but what is God's purpose through it? I hear people always say, there's a reason for everything that happens, and that is true. There is a reason. There is a cause. But that's not the same as God's purpose. You can determine the reason for something, and it doesn't change a thing. But when you understand God's purpose, it can change everything. And what Job and the three friends spent 35 chapters trying to figure out was the reason for Job's suffering. God says, I have a purpose in it. And the purpose is more important than the reason. Trust me that my purpose is best. C.H. Spurgeon said, we're sure to get into mischief when we begin to classify God and start asking why and wherefore. God turns question marks into exclamation points when we focus on Him, on His grace and His goodness. Remember, we live on promises, not explanations. And the promise is God has a purpose in each of our lives. And when we trust Him, we will see it come about. Secondly, we're reassured that God is always there, especially in our difficult times. Like the story of footprints, when God carried the person through the rough times, He's always there. Now, He's not always obvious. There were times when, in the story of Job, God was silent. He did not answer Job's questions. He did not appear as quickly as Job wanted. And there may be times in our lives when it seems that God is a million miles away. It seems that He is silent. It seems that He is inactive. But we need to understand that God's silence does not mean God's absence. He is always there. He is at work in ways we don't see, and frankly, we couldn't comprehend. And that's where our trust in Him comes in. Then finally, we are reminded of the perspective of eternity. the book of Job ought to shape our expectation of the normal Christian life. And I was struck by something I read this last week. The end comes at the end. You say, Captain Obvious is looking for a promotion. Yeah, the end comes at the end. But understand this. We have come to the end of Job's story. We see how it all turns out. We are not yet at the end of our own story. Our book is still being written. And we don't know if we're closer to the beginning or closer to the end, though we might have a pretty good idea. But we don't know what God has in store for us in this life. We don't know the passages God will bring us through, but we do know He will bring us through them. In the middle of the book of Job, Job was full of questions. He was full of doubts. He couldn't figure things out. He didn't know how things were going to end up. He was in the middle of the story. Now he comes to the end, and in the end, all things are set right. In the end, his faith and his faithfulness are rewarded. But it wasn't that obvious in the middle. You and I are still in the middle of our stories. We're still in the battle. We don't know exactly what's going to happen in the days, in the months, in the years ahead. And we may go through difficult times. We may go through suffering. We may go through loss. Just remember, the end comes at the end. And when the end comes, God will write the final chapter in our life. And He'll get it right. I'm reminded of a conversation recorded in Matthew 19, verses 27 to 29. Peter, I'm imagining speaking for all the disciples, says to Jesus, "We've left everything to follow you. What then will there be for us?" And Jesus replied, "I tell you the truth, at the renewal of all things, when the Son of Man sits on His glorious throne, you who have followed Me will also sit on 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. And everyone who has left houses or brothers or sisters or father or mother or children or fields for My sake will receive 100 times as much and inherit eternal life." Now, I imagine that there are some preachers on TV that will jump all over this and say, "See, when you send Me $100, God will send you $1,000. That's not what Jesus is saying here. Because notice when this will happen. When the end comes. When the Son of Man is seated on His glorious throne. Is that happening yet? No. It's at the end. The end happens at the end. That is when all things will be set straight. That is when we will receive our reward. That is when, in the words of Jesus, you will receive eternal life. I'm not saying God won't bless us in this life. He may. He doesn't have to. Not everybody will see financial, material blessing. We've got to be careful that we don't misinterpret the final chapter of Job and conclude that every trial will end with the problems all solved, all hurt feelings forgiven, everybody living happily ever after. That's not this life. The end comes at the end. And what we have to look forward to is an eternity of reward. An eternity where there will be no more sin and no more sorrow and no more suffering, no more separation. That's the end. That's the final chapter, and God always writes the final chapter. We can trust God to do what is right, no matter how painful our situation might be. I began by talking of stories that ended and they lived happily ever after. I think it's probably more accurate in Job's case and in our own to conclude, and they lived happily forever after. It is eternal life that we look forward to. And yes, we are thankful for the blessings that we have now. And we should be. Every good thing we enjoy comes from the hand of God. We have been blessed. But our best life is not now. Our best life is what happens at the end. And that is when God will set it all straight. He will right every wrong. And He'll close the chapter of that book when we live happily forever after.